Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and our special guest is Peter Schiff. Peter is the CEO of Euro Pacific Capital and best-selling author of The Real Crash, America's Coming Bankruptcy, How to Save Yourself and Your Country. He also hosts of the nationally syndicated Peter Schiff Show, heard daily from 1 to 3 Pacific Time at schiffradio.com. Peter, welcome back to our show.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
Euro Pacific Capital, can you tell me what it does?
Oh, yeah. Well, we're a broker-dealer and a registered investment advisor. So we work with mainly individual investors on helping them build portfolios, chiefly of non-U.S. assets. And the reason that I focus on foreign stocks and bonds and natural resources and precious metals is because my major concern is for the value of the U.S. dollar. I think at the end of this crisis is a dollar crisis. I think that's where all the chickens come home to roost. The Fed is going to keep on printing money until the bottom drops out of the dollar. And when it does, I think Americans are going to be wiped out if their investments and their savings are denominated in dollars. So we look for stronger currencies. We invest in places like Switzerland, Norway, New Zealand, Australia, Singapore, Hong Kong. We buy quality companies that pay good dividends in currencies that I think are going to retain their value and not lose their value due to massive money printing.
I'm just curious, your experience in speaking about a crash prior to anything bad happening, let's say in 2006 or so, how was the reception at that point, and how did that change after some of what you said came true?
Well, from 2005, really, to 2007, I got a lot of press coverage, a lot of TV coverage for my forecasts, and the CNBC started calling me Dr. Doom, and I got a lot of airtime because I was one of the only people that was negative. So if you wanted to balance out all the positive analysts, I was one of the few people that you could go to. And generally, people just kind of brought me on and made fun of me because of all the crazy things I was saying about the housing bubble and the looming financial crisis and the artificial recovery and all the things the Fed was doing wrong that were going to lead to disaster. And so everybody dismissed me as some kind of Chicken Little. And then when everything collapsed pretty much along the lines that I said it would, some people started to give me credit for it. But what a lot of people in the media started to do is just ignore me.
Exactly. They just quit interviewing.
The people that were having me on their shows stopped having me on. Most of the shows that I'm on now are totally different shows than the shows that I was on back then. The shows that I used to be a regular on when I was predicting crisis, they don't have me on anymore. But they have the same people on that were laughing at me. Those people are still invited on. But I'm nowhere. And I think they don't like to be reminded of the fact that I warned about the crisis and they all laughed at me. They want to pretend that nobody could have seen it coming because it makes them look better. Because the problem is the same fools who are oblivious to the 2008 financial crisis are oblivious to the next one that's even bigger. They're singing the same song as they did back then. Everything is fine. And anybody who questions that, I mean, look at the reception that David Stockman got for writing his article in the New York Times. I mean, he was eviscerated from everybody.
Yeah.
For pointing out what should be obvious, that this recovery is phony, and that when the Fed's, Novocaine wears off, the stimulus, that we're in for a world of pain.
Well, what you just mentioned, government intervention, certainly has helped assets that call California real estate, for instance. Is the reverse also true? In other words, it shouldn't have happened to real estate the way it did. Has it also negatively affected things that should have worked better than they did?
Well, real estate prices are too high, and certainly in California, they're much too high. The prices started to correct in 2007, 2008. That was a good thing. The government should get out of the way and let prices continue to fall because they're too high. But the government doesn't want that because the banks are all levered up, exposed to this real estate collateral. And so rather than allow the market to correct the imbalance, the Fed is trying to blow more air into the bubble to try to delay the day of reckoning. But all this does is further damage the underlying structure of the economy. We are diverting our resources into housing that are badly needed in other sectors, but they're not going there. And so as a result, we're not going to have a real recovery. We're not going to create jobs for the unemployed. All we're going to do is pile more debt on the debt that we already have so we can go on spending more money that we don't have to buy things that we can't afford. And this is going to lead to a bigger disaster than the 2008 financial crisis, because the Fed is doing exactly what it did to cause the last bubble, except they're doing it much bigger. And so the consequences will be bigger when this bubble bursts.
Well, you know, one of the things that your title has done is really touch on a third rail, and that's called America's bankruptcy. So I guess if you were in the mainstream media, that probably would be an interview you go, I don't know if we're ready for that one.
Yeah, and you know, David Stockman, in his piece, he basically advocates a one-time 30% wealth tax on the rich to pay down the debt. See, I don't advocate that. I think we should default on the debt, and then the rich people who own bonds will lose out. You know, now I don't think we should completely default. I think we should restructure, but it is really impossible, mathematically impossible, for us to ever pay off the debt, the money that we've borrowed. It just, there is no realistic way to get the tax revenue from the American citizens to repay the debt. And the only reason that we can maintain the illusion of an ability to service this debt is because the Fed is buying $1 trillion worth of it every year and keeping interest rates at zero, so that in 2013, the projected cost of interest on the national debt is only about $228 billion. The last time our interest bill was that low, Ronald Reagan was president. But we've added, you know, $14 trillion in debt since then, yet we haven't added one dime in interest payments on that debt, thanks to the Fed. But eventually, interest rates have to go up. And when they do, we can't pay.
Okay. Same story is probably be playing out in Japan.
Well, Japan has got a problem, too, in that debt to GDP is about 240%, which is larger than ours, although our debt to GDP numbers are not accurate because they don't count the debt that the government has guaranteed, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, student loans. You know, when you throw all that on top, we have a higher debt to GDP than Japan. And, of course, the bigger problem is that Japan's GDP is actually more legitimate than ours, because ours is a bunch of fluff. It's service sector, it's healthcare, it's retail, it's finance, it's education, whereas Japan has a lot of manufacturing and a lot of exports. So they have a more reliable legitimate GDP than we do. So I think the numbers are worse. But the one thing that Japan has in common with us is foolish monetary policy, because the Bank of Japan is printing a lot of yen in order to drive down the value of the currency so that prices will rise and Japanese consumers will have to pay more money for the things that they need, and that the value of Japanese savings and wages will go down. So, you know, stupid economic policy, you know, we don't have a monopoly on it. Japan has it, but I think Japan is in better shape than the United States. They're not in perfect shape.
When you talk about a bankruptcy, you're not talking about walking away from our debt. You are talking about either one of two things, where you restructure the debt or you print your way out of it. Which of those is less painful?
Well, I'm trying to avoid the printing press method. I mean, because since it's physically impossible to pay off the debt, the only question is, how do we default on that? Now, the way that, you know, we're planning on doing it is to inflate, to just print money and to pay our creditors back with money that has a lot less value than the money they loaned us. And if we print enough money, we'll pay people back with worthless money, which is the same thing as a complete default. I think that the best way to get out from under the problem is to admit that we can't afford to pay and to renegotiate the terms of the debt and to have a reduction in the principal that we owe and to impose a haircut on our creditors honestly, as opposed to doing it dishonestly through inflation. Because I think the economic damage from an honest approach is going to be far less severe to everybody, including our creditors, than if we simply inflate the debts away. Because that will not only wipe out our creditors, but it'll wipe out our country and destroy the economy completely.
Okay, who are the creditors we're talking about, by and large?
Well, you know, the largest creditor is the Federal Reserve itself, number one. But they don't really count. And then you've got intra-government agencies like the so-called Social Security Trust Funds, which don't really count. But you know, you've got intra-government debt. But then you've got central banks, you know, foreign central banks outside the United States are the next biggest holders. You know, China and Japan together, they hold over $2 trillion worth of treasuries. You know, so some of the losses would be, you know, borne by them. But, of course, U.S. American investors own U.S. Treasury bonds. They own mutual funds, their pensions. Insurance companies own Treasury bonds. Banks own Treasury bonds. And so there would be losses there as well. But there's going to be losses no matter how we look at it. Either the losses are going to come about due to depreciation of the currency, inflation, or due to a default. So there's going to be losses. The question is, what is the best way to do it? What is the least economically damaging way to do it? And when you default legitimately, the loser is the person who bought the bond. If you create inflation, everybody loses, even people that don't own any of the bonds. You know, people that have their money stuffed under their mattresses lose. So I'd rather punish the people who engage in the activity. I think anybody who is buying U.S. treasuries is basically loaning money to a bankrupt nation. And, you know, they're deserving to lose money. I mean, if they did their homework, they wouldn't buy treasuries. They would realize that the government isn't good for the money. So if you go out and you lend money to somebody who can't pay you back, you deserve to lose. You don't need a bailout where your losses are socialized. That's really what happens is when they create inflation, they try to spread the losses among everybody in the country, even the people that had that were not involved in the transaction. I mean, somebody could have their money in private investments because they don't trust government bonds. Why should they be taxed to subsidize the losses for people who were dumb enough to lend money to the U.S. government?
Well, what's the hit on credibility? Choice A or choice B?
Well, most likely they're going to do inflation if that was choice A, because that's the easy way out. You know, if we default, we have to officially acknowledge that we can't pay. If we print, we still pretend that we're paying. And then when prices skyrocket, the politicians blame speculators. They blame OPEC. They'll blame greedy capitalists who are gouging consumers with high prices. You know, they won't accept responsibility for the inflation. They'll try to, you know, create scapegoats. So that is the most politically convenient and expedient way to do it, which is why so many nations have gone down that route. And it's always been a disaster.
Well, you know, that's what's interesting. It seems like we have a blueprint, but we're repeating the same process.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, in other areas of human endeavors, science, you know, medicine, you know, each generation builds on what the prior generation learned. And so we're always advancing. We're always progressing. But when it comes to economics, we don't learn anything. Each generation simply repeats all the mistakes of the previous generation and learns nothing. And I think a lot of that has to do with human nature. It's basically, you know, people act in their own self-interest. People want something for nothing, and that never changes. So voters vote for politicians that promise something for nothing. Politicians want to get elected, and all they care about is how to do that. And you have to pursue a certain kind of policy to get elected, which is kick the can down the road, which is, you know, try to postpone the pain as long as possible, even if it exacerbates the pain, because you're worsening the underlying condition. So humans haven't changed. I mean, 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, I mean, we're the same mentally. You know, we all act the same way. So no matter how much more science we know, no matter how much more technology we have, we still repeat those basic human mistakes. And what other people have to recognize is just, you know, that this happens. And it's not hard. You know, those who do not study history are condemned to repeat it. It's not hard. You know, it's not rocket science. You know, you see what's happened, and, you know, it happens over and over and over again, and you just have to prepare for it. And generally, the majority of people are surprised by things that happen. You know, the financial crisis of 2008 shocked just about everybody, except anybody who understood history. Anybody who really understood economics was prepared for it. It's just a vast majority of the public, and certainly of, you know, the establishment, you know, we're shocked because they're brainwashed.
Well, anytime you write a negative report, don't talk about anybody's negative report, and it's not happening right then, it's very hard to accept because the feeling of that investment, let's say, is so good and comfortable, and you're talking about getting out of it completely. It's hard, and that's what you're talking about, is human nature definitely doesn't want to go through all of that.
Yeah, I mean, I experienced that as a broker firsthand. You know, back in the 1990s, trying to convince people to sell their internet stocks or some of their tech stocks, and no, I mean, nobody wanted to part with these things. And then the same thing trying to convince people in 03, 04, 05 to sell their houses in California in particular. And no, nobody wanted to do that. So they wanted to buy more houses. You know, that's a mania. I mean, it infects your perception. You can't see. You know, you can't see the forest for the trees, you know, or, you know, you're in a bubble, and so you don't know it's a bubble because you're inside it, so you can't tell, you know. It was easier for me to see the bubble because I was an outsider looking at it. So I knew that they were in a bubble, but they were in there with everybody else and, you know, I had no idea. And of course, a lot of people have a vested interest, the people that are work on Wall Street. I mean, they don't want to believe that the stock market is only going up because of the Fed. They want to believe that it's legitimate, that the economy is actually improving. Because if they acknowledge it's a bubble, then they know it's going to burst. They want to assume that it can go on forever, and therefore they have to assume that the rally is legitimate, that it's based on real positive fundamentals instead of just bubble blowing by the Fed and cheap money.
What are the benefits of being the reserve currency, and how long do you say we have before that might change?
Yeah, well, the benefit, you know, it's a double-edged sword. I mean, it was a benefit and a curse at the same time. The benefit is that you can live beyond your means. That's also the curse, right? I mean, because we can print money, we don't have to work as hard as other people. We don't have to produce as much. We can just run money off a printing press, and we can use it to buy oil. We can use it to buy manufactured goods. We could use it to buy all sorts of things. Other nations don't have that privilege. I mean, if you're in Australia and you want to import goods from China, you have to export something to China. You have to make something that the Chinese want in order to buy the things that the Chinese have. But Americans don't have to do that. If we want goods made in China, we just run some more hundreds off a printing press. That's all we have to do. Other countries can't do that. But the fact that we had the benefit of that, it's also been a curse because we've relied on that. So now our economy has transformed itself over the past couple of generations to where we're now dependent on our ability to print money and export it, to import the products that our country is no longer capable of producing. And the problem is eventually the dollar is going to collapse and then our economy goes with it. You know, it's like, you know, if let's say your people, you're living on an island and maybe you used to go out and fish all the time and catch fish and everybody knew how to fish. But then, you know, all of a sudden, you know, somebody started just dumping free fish on the island. And so no one had a fish. And maybe they did that for two or three generations, and people got used to this free food, and everybody forgot how to fish because all the people who knew how to fish died, and no one even had any fishing rods anymore because there was no use for them because you got all this free fish. And then, you know, if the free food stops coming, you can all starve to death if nobody remembers how to fish, and nobody even has any fishing equipment. Mm-hmm. You know, so that's kind of the situation where we used to manufacture, we used to export, and now we don't do it anymore. Because we just live off of what we get for free from everybody else. But the problem is the rest of the world doesn't realize they're giving us all this stuff for free. They think we're paying them because they've got trillions of dollars, you know, stockpiled up. But when the dollar collapses and they realize that they're not worth anything because they can't buy anything because we're not making anything, then the bubble bursts, the dollar crashes, and then, you know, we're out of luck. And then, you know, Walmart is going to be a ghost town. The shelves are going to be empty, and the few things that are there are going to be, you know, it's going to be like, you know, Saks Fifth Avenue.
Okay. That'll be a bad day for Walmart. If what you say occurs and the United States isn't a reserve currency or the dollar's not reserve currency, what takes its place?
I don't know. Maybe gold. You know, gold is money. I mean, gold, the only reason that the dollar became the reserve currency was because it was backed by gold. Not only was it backed by gold, it was legally redeemable in gold. When the dollar became the reserve currency, if you took $35 to the Treasury, they handed you an ounce of gold. They were required by law to do that. So the dollar was backed by gold. It's not backed by gold anymore, so we need to go back to gold as the reserve. Because when the dollar was the reserve currency, gold was the reserve because the dollar was as good as gold. In fact, it was better than gold because the dollar paid interest and gold did not. But now that the dollar is just another piece of paper with absolutely no intrinsic value and nothing behind it, then what sense is it to have the dollar as a reserve? I mean, how do you anchor your currency to something that's adrift? You know, that's not going to give you any stability. You know, you need to anchor your currency to something that's stable, like gold. And so I think that we're going to go back on the gold standard. I don't think there's any single currency that can replace the dollar because there's no currency that's currently backed by anything. Now, if a currency were to back itself by gold and to have enough gold reserves to pull it off, then maybe they can get back to that position of trust. But that might take some time. So I think the most likely thing is the dollar collapses and the main reserve will be gold. Although there probably will be central banks will probably hold foreign currencies in reserve of various central banks. But the percentage of that will be dollars will be dramatically reduced from what it is today.
If that all happens, how does that affect the U.S. citizen's lifestyle?
Well, it's going to be dramatically diminished. Americans are in for a big decline in their standard of living because our money is going to lose value, our purchasing power is going to plunge, and many things that Americans take for granted today will be unaffordable. Things that are now common will be luxuries. And Americans are going to have to find a way to get by with a lot less. You know, they're going to use a lot less energy. They're not going to drive their cars as often. Maybe they're not even going to own. A lot of American households have two or three cars. They might sell two. They're going to be left with one. Americans might find themselves renting out rooms in their houses. Two families may live in a house where now there's one or generations. Parents moving in with their children, children moving in with their parents. Americans are not going to be shopping as much for things. I mean, people are going to learn to sew again. You know, when people repair things. I mean, right now, your television breaks, you just go buy a new one. People aren't going to be doing that. They're going to be repairing their old television sets. People aren't going to be getting a new cell phone every year, every two. They're going to have the same cell phone for 5 or 10 years. I mean, we just don't have the money. We don't have the resources. Things are going to be too expensive. And so we're going to have to be rationing down our lifestyle. And that means the whole economy is going to change. I mean, we have more retail space in America than any other country per capita. We have more shopping space than any other place. That's going to change. A lot of these shopping centers are going to shut down because there's not going to be anybody shopping there because no one's going to have any money. The prices are going to be too high for Americans to buy stuff. You know, I mean, maybe, you know, we'll be buying used stuff more. People will be, you know, doing that, but we're not going to be buying brand new stuff the way we're used to. Americans are going to be spending much bigger percentages of their incomes on food and energy. You know, right now, maybe the typical household spends 10%, 15% of his income on food and energy. You know, after the crash, that might be 30% or 40%. So what are Americans going to give up when they have to spend so much money just to eat? And of course, you know, Americans are going to have to, you know, move their diet down. They're not going to be eating as much, you know, fresh fish or beef. People are going to eat more potatoes, you know, cheap stuff.
Okay.
Because a potato is probably going to cost what a steak costs now.
Peter, give us some information on your website. We've got 45 seconds left.
Well, the website for my company, Europe Pacific Capital that we mentioned, is europac.net, EuropaC.net. Also, I have a precious metals company. You can find it, Schiff Gold, schiffgold.com. And I do my own radio show now. If people want to listen on the internet, it's at schiffradio.com. Again, schiffradio.com. I'm on 5 days a week from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern time, Monday through Friday.
Peter, thank you. Just to wrap up, Peter's written a book called The Real Crash, and it's a very interesting read. I recommend that you get it. And our clientele basically is real estate. We're going to talk a little bit about that in our next segment. Thank you, Peter, for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.